level of violence. It can only happen in a nation with a history like ours, history of slavery. And I could go on and on. The fact that we are the most punitive and incarcerate the most of any nation on earth, including those nations that we call totalitarian, goes back to slavery. Hmm. And the fact that we can have all of these police killings, you know, where police will call our youth monsters and demons, you know, like with Ferguson, can only happen in a nation like ours with a history like ours that goes back to genocide and slavery. And in many ways, we are still suffering from that because we haven't healed those original wounds.
Welcome to On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, voices of resistance from the nation's capital, produced for WPFW Pacifica Radio in Washington, D.C. I'm Esther Ivera, and for April 2017's episode of The F Word, our monthly discussion of fascism, I'm honored to speak today to Fania Davis. She's co-founder and director of Restorative Justice for Oakland Youth and a longtime social justice activist, professor, and civil rights attorney with a PhD in indigenous knowledge. She came of age in Birmingham, Alabama, during the civil rights movement and the murder of two close childhood friends in the 1963 Sunday school bombing crystallized within her a passionate commitment to social transformation. Welcome to On the Ground, Fania.
Thank you, Esther. Good to be here.
Well, in the time that we've been doing these F-word series, there have been two dominant strains in these discussions about fascism. One utilizes George Jackson's definition about fascism being the complete control of the state by monopoly capital, when the relationship between the state and the corporation becomes indiscernible. And the other strain looks at the state of totalitarianism and violence that African and indigenous people have lived under in the United States. And so when I read your bio, it seemed to me that your life, as well as your work in restorative justice, just might sit at the intersection of these two strains. So I want you to first give me an overview of your thoughts about American forms of fascism today.
Yes, I would adopt the definition that I kind of grew up with as a socialist, as a communist, member of the Communist Party, and also as an activist who attended the National Committee to Combat Fascism conference that was organized by the Panthers in 1969. And that is, fascism is ruled by the most extreme right-wing and reactionary sections of capital. And today, I see elements of fascism. I don't see a victory of fascism, but I certainly see very alarming elements of fascism. I've identified it six or seven. Number one, Trump has assembled the most right-wing presidential cabinet in history, and the most notable examples of that would, of course, be Sessions, who called his Black Staff member boy, and who called the NAACP communist, and who says the only bad thing about the KKK is they smoke marijuana. And, of course, Bannon, who is flagrantly anti-Semitic, racist, and identifies with white supremacist and white nationalist groups, especially through his Breitbart news. Secondly, Trump has filled his cabinet with billionaires, the likes of which we just haven't seen, at least not in the past century. It's one of the richest cabinets in modern history, and collectively they represent multi-billions of dollars. And I think this is what George was getting at, this absolute concentration of corporate power when corporations directly take over the reins of political power. There's no more middlemen anymore, basically, that you have to bribe. And there's no distinction between the corporate executives and the government executives. And so corporate economic power is completely merged with political power, and it's what Naomi Klein calls a corporate coup d'etat.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition, we see a third element, scapegoating and identifying scapegoating and invoking a terrifying enemy that's a threat to our national security. And, of course, this is done to stoke fears, and then once you have people afraid, you can control them, and then you promise to rescue them from those fears. In Germany, it was communism that was the specter, and it was followed by the so-called world conspiracy of world Jewry. And today, with Trump, it's Muslims. So that is another element. And an additional element would be not so much the control of the press, which we see historically in fascist regimes, that the press is shut down, they are disempowered, but we have an attack on the press as the enemy of the people in the Trump administration.
Mm-hmm.
And then a fifth element that we're seeing here is, well, not so much a suppression of dissent, but we certainly see a specter of totalitarianism in the ability of the NSA to place all of us under surveillance, under absolute surveillance, you know, with technology today. And, you know, which, by the way, Obama advanced more than any other president, unfortunately, historically.
Right.
And then lastly, we see a president who appears to represent the most extreme right-wing and reactionary sections of capital. He is basing his politics on hate and fear. He is heteropatriarchal. He is racist. He is xenophobic. He is homophobic. He is transphobic. He is misogynistic. But it's really interesting because when we look at fascists historically, like Hitler and Mussolini and Franco, they have been very methodical and calculating and very intentional, very clear, very strategic ideologues, very charismatic in moving people and appealing to their fear. But in Trump, we don't see really an ideologue. As Noam Chomsky said, Trump is not an ideologue. His only ideology is me. And he also adds that in some ways we're fortunate in this country because we've seen extreme right-wingers in power like Nixon and even McCarthy during the McCarthy era. But McCarthy, he says, was a thug and could only get so far in terms of mass appeal. And similarly with Nixon, who was a crook, he could only get so far in mass appeal. And with Trump, he's saying Trump is a clown, and I guess the suggestion is that he will only get so far in mass appeal. But I don't know about underestimating Trump. You know, we've underestimated him from the beginning, and he always manages to defy our expectations about him. So there's no complete victory of fascism, although there are a number of elements present. And one of the other things that I want to say about why we don't see a complete victory is there is just a mass movement, a resistance, a Trump resistance, the likes of which we have just never seen historically. And in some ways we were prepared for this resistance by the 8 years of the Obama administration. And one of the best things, I think, of those 8 years was the historic flourishing of social justice movements.
So I was actually surprised that you said that there was a flourishing of social justice issues under Obama, because a lot of the activists I speak to feel that the movements kind of went to sleep under Obama, that they kind of were lulled into this, especially the anti-war, the peace movement was kind of lulled into inaction under Obama.
Yeah, you know, it's complex because I do think that that's true. There were not real movements that were focused on Obama and demanding that he stop the drones, you know, stop killing civilians, demanding that he roll back his really retrogressive immigration policies, demanding that he, you know, not make so many inroads into our First and into our Fourth Amendment rights and, you know, the privacy inroads with surveillance. That's correct. There were not those kinds of movements on the one hand. On the other hand, we saw a flourishing of social justice movements, one after the next. Occupy, Bernie, Black Lives Matter, LGBTQ, Dreamers, the Sanctuary Movement, the Climate Justice Movement, anti-mass incarceration movements. That happened. There was just a succession of movements that rose up, the likes of which I don't think we've seen since the 60s, or even if we saw it then. So even though those movements in many cases were not directed at the Obama administration specifically, they nonetheless were very powerful and very energetic and very vigorous in the way that they arose during those 8 years. But I think in some ways that those movements have prepared us. I mean, because, well, you know, for a while, many people were saying that the youth, why aren't they active, and it's the me generation, and, you know, we were so active in the 60s, and now there's very little going on. And a lot of elders in my generation were a little sad about that. But suddenly, you know, with Black Lives Matter, for example, my gosh, that was historic, what our youth did. And, you know, what the youth did at Standing Rock. So I cannot overestimate this amazing and historic flourishing of movements that occurred during the Obama years. And for me, that's the best thing that came out of the Obama years in many ways. And so I think this is all going to the point of how we're seeing why I don't think there's been a victory of fascism as yet, not only because of those movements preceding the Trump victory, but since the Trump victory, we have just seen a crescendoing of movements that are arising with great vigor and speed, and the size is amazing. I mean, look at the Women's March, for example, the largest march in the history of this country. In 600 cities, a million in D.C., and I was there, and there were 200 demonstrations nationally. And aside from the record-breaking numbers, some really amazing things were happening at that rally. And what I'm speaking of is the profound and thoroughgoing intersectionality in the messaging of that march. Almost every speaker echoed the refrain that mass incarceration, state-sanctioned violence against black people, sexual assault, environmental justice, racism, Islamophobia, transphobia, water, health care, disabled rights, immigrant rights, climate justice, LGBTQ rights, economic justice, as well as reproductive rights and equal work for equal pay, are all women's issues.
You know, I'm so glad you mentioned that, because it's, well, two things that I saw happen. That first, it seemed like the march had to be prodded into intersectionality, that it wasn't necessarily intersectional at first. And then second, I'm wondering, from you being there, whether there was this, whether in essence the crowd was more radical and more forward thinking than the stage. I heard from some friends who went, and I was out of the country at the time, that, you know, there was a lot of intersectionality and a lot of kind of that forward vision in the crowd, but a lot of things coming from the stage were really not necessarily making those connections, and they definitely weren't getting to the idea of fighting fascism as much as kind of fighting Trump.
Now, the latter I would agree with, but to say that there wasn't this intersectional, profoundly intersectional messaging from the stage, that is not my experience. Mm-hmm. I was blown away, because that's the first rally I have attended in my life and long life of activism where the messaging from the stage was so deeply intersectional.
Awesome.
They had people talking there talking about police violence. They had people there talking about climate justice. There was someone there talking about the water in Flint. There were people there talking about LGBT. All of those subjects had speakers, and many of the speakers themselves mentioned, even if they were climate justice activists, they would talk about the need to fight against police violence. And police violence folk would talk about the need to fight for disabled rights and the whole gamut of other issues. So that wasn't my experience. I thought the messaging, actually the people in the audience so many of them were first-time protesters. That's the other thing I noticed. And they probably weren't as sophisticated in many ways. And I mean, I think they agreed with the intersectional message that was being echoed, I think, from the stage. But they weren't necessarily sophisticated social justice activists because, as I said, for so many, this is the first time that they attended a demonstration. So, I mean, I think that Women's March was historic, and you're totally right. It started with the kind of a dream of a white woman in Hawaii who said, let's do a million-woman march, or let's do a march, you know, the day after the election or the inauguration of Trump.
Right.
And she woke up the next morning, and there were 10,000 yeses on social media.
Right.
And so these white women started to organize it, but, you know, before long, and I'm really glad that it developed this way, women of color, Islamic woman, Laura, I can't remember her last name, and Mallory, and, you know.
Oh, Tamika Mallory.
Mallory. And it became a very, you know, a much more diverse and inclusive organizing committee, including my daughter. She was on the organizing committee for the march. And my sister spoke there.
Oh,
it was kind of a family affair. But I have been to the march on Washington. You know, I've been to major marches in Europe and in this country, marches for my sister, you know, of tens of thousands of people all over the world. And this march for me was just the most intersectional and in many ways, therefore, the most moving, because we weren't just there to protest about a single issue. So even though this was not an anti-fascist or anti-Trump, well, it was anti-Trump explicitly, but it's correct to say it was not explicitly anti-fascist. And I didn't hear that level of political sophistication in the speeches. True. However, objectively speaking, this Women's March and the women all over the country who were represented there, including the fact that women are now running for political office to a much greater degree than ever before, it's an important element of an anti-Trump, of an anti-fascist coalition.
You know, I have to say that probably for a number of people who, you know, just don't know the history that well, including myself, they won't know that you are Angela Davis's sister. And so, just so the listeners know, when you say your sister, you mean Angela Davis.
I mean Angela Davis, that I'm proud to say.
Yes. So, can you talk to us about restorative justice and talk about how, if fascist trends in this country are connected to the corporatized and militarized way that the justice system is being handled and how it continues to target people of color?
So you're asking, number one, what is restorative justice?
Mm-hmm.
And you're asking about fascist trends and how they're connected to the corporatized and militarized justice system and how this impacts? Okay. So restorative justice is a worldview and a theory of justice. Many people think of restorative justice as a theory of justice or even simply as a conflict resolution program. But it's also a worldview, a philosophy, and a way of life that is rooted in indigenous principles, the most fundamental of which is the principle that we on this planet, the four-leggeds, the two-leggeds, the ones that fly in the air and swim through the waters, all of us are connected in this beautiful and luminous web of wholeness. And it is rooted, restorative justice is rooted in the notion that we are all relatives, Mitakio Yasin, as the Sioux would say, or Ubuntu, as African traditionalists would say, or In Lakesh, I am the other you, we are one. So restorative justice is very deeply rooted in these indigenous teachings and principles. And unfortunately, many people don't acknowledge that. Even practitioners don't honor the indigenous roots of restorative justice. So even though the restorative justice movement has been going on only since the mid-70s, in fact, it's an ancient way of thinking about and doing justice. So restorative justice invites a paradigm shift in the way that we think about and do justice, from a punitive justice that replicates and reproduces harm to a restorative justice that seeks to repair and heal it. One way that you can think about the difference in paradigms between our justice, our prevailing justice paradigm, and restorative justice is to ask, to do this exercise. We call it the three-question exercise. You could say that our prevailing justice system asks these three questions. Number one, what law or rule was broken? Number two, who broke it? And number three, how should that person be punished? So it's about blaming and judging, fundamentally, our entire criminal justice system. Mm-hmm. You could say that restorative justice asks a completely different set of questions. Number one, who was harmed? Who was harmed? Number two, what are the needs and responsibilities of everyone impacted by the harm, the needs and the responsibilities? Number three, how does everybody impacted come together and address those needs and responsibilities and heal the harm as much as possible? So it's a justice that shifts the locus of power from systems and professionals to communities, resolving their own conflicts in a collaborative and a collective way. It responds to the initial harm with an impulse to heal. You could say that ours is a system, our current system, is a system that harms people who harm people to show that harming people is wrong. If I hurt you, that creates an imbalance in the scales of justice. And the only way to rebalance the scales is to cause me harm. So that's what I mean when I say that our system harms people who harm people to show that harming people is wrong. And it just replicates and reproduces and metastasizes harm. And restorative justice seeks to interrupt that cycle of mm-hmm. harm. Because restorative justice is a philosophy, a set of principles, it's not limited to the justice system. It's not even limited to discipline systems in schools. It can be used to address conflicts and build relationships in schools and families and workplaces. And it is even used to address mass social conflict, as in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa. So that's restorative justice. Now, would you repeat the second part of your question?
How, since you work in restorative justice, how you see those fascist trends in the country that you described earlier connecting to how the justice system is more corporatized and militarized, and how you see that impacting the either the ability to have restorative justice or the strength of or the strength of the kind of the prison industrial complex.
Yes. And yeah, I guess a question that kind of is suggested by what you've just said is, can it push back the criminal or the prison industrial complex?
Mm-hmm.
And I would say, yes, it has the capacity to do that because it creates a totally different way, a non-punitive way of addressing wrongdoing and harm. And it is very, very effective. The diversion programs that are now bubbling up all over the country, restorative diversion programs, or they call them restorative community conferencing programs, are increasingly being evaluated, and we're finding that the recidivism of youth and adults who go through these restorative justice programs plummets, whereas the prevailing recidivism rates for people who have been incarcerated, and they come out, their chances are 75 to 90% in the state of California that they will recidivate, they will go back inside because they commit another crime. However, when they go through these restorative justice diversion programs, their recidivism plummets to about 11%. Mm-hmm, and I'm speaking specifically of a study that has been released about a Bay Area program and another one that's just about to come out. And but these are the trends nationally, that restorative justice is very effective when it is well facilitated in reducing recidivism and stopping reoffending and promoting accountability and promoting empathy on the part of persons causing harm and promoting healing between persons harmed and persons who have caused that harm. And we're seeing in schools similar results where we've been able to interrupt the school-to-prison pipeline through restorative justice and, if intentional enough about it, reduce racial disparities in the process. But in many schools, after 1 or 2 years of restorative justice, we've been able to reduce suspension rates by more than 50%. And that is significant when we talk about interrupting mass incarceration, because when a child is suspended once by the ninth grade, her chances of being incarcerated triple from one suspension. So when we say we are decreasing suspension significantly through restorative justice, some schools in Oakland, which has a restorative justice public policy now, some schools are not suspending our youth at all. That is very important when it comes to interrupting the school-to-prison pipeline. So all of the studies show, whether we're talking about restorative justice in schools or in the justice system, criminal justice or juvenile justice, that restorative justice provides a very powerful way, a different way of addressing harm and crime and wrongdoing in our communities. So it has the potential, to get back to your question, to provide an alternative or an antidote to the prison industrial complex.
Hold that thought. We're going to take a brief break and then pick up on this subject about the prison industrial complex. We'll be right back. If you're just tuning in, this is On the Ground, produced for WPFW Pacifica Radio in Washington, D.C. I'm Esther Averam, and I'm in conversation with veteran activist, attorney, and restorative justice expert, Fania Davis. You know, when we talk about fascism, we talk about corporate control that directly links to the prison industrial complex. But when I look at some of the different things happening right now, I'm wondering if what you think about this idea that there's something else happening in addition to the corporate profit motive. And the reason I'm thinking about a couple of things, like every time you see a police incident happening now, like there have been a number of new videos coming out where these New York City police are taunting these black high school students, like threatening to like tase them because they're like they're just walking on the sidewalk too slow or something. And so there's a sense that this is being unleashed, that there's even less protection from this type of racist encounter with the police, and that these systems are being used to kind of placate white nationalists who just want the chains taken off of them to just
act out in any kind of way they want. And in these prisons, people are being made to work under slave-like conditions. So all these things are happening. So just talk about whether there's another motive in addition to the profit motive.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you've answered that question. You've made the case for a yes answer very well to that question. And I would add that, you know, maybe there is some element of wanting to placate white nationalists. Maybe there is some psychological motivation in that sense, you know, of intentional racism, and flagrant, unapologetic, unabashed racism psychologically. And I want to just say that race is definitely a motive, because race has always been very embedded with capitalism. And in this case, we're talking about the prison industrial complex, that section of capitalism. Race, the whole idea of race, didn't get started historically until the emergence of both slavery and capitalism. Race has no biological or genetic basis. We all know that. I think that's widely accepted now, that race is not a scientific or biological phenomenon. It is socially constructed. We didn't talk about whiteness, you know, until about 500 or so years ago. It didn't exist in people's minds. It is socially constructed, and whiteness and race are inventions and products of the slave trade and the emergence of a sort of capitalism that relies upon the reproduction and exploitation of notions of racial difference. And this is racial capitalism. That's what Cedric Robinson called it. Slavery is the capital that made capitalism in this country, and genocide is the capital that made capitalism. So the two are inextricably linked. And the prison industrial complex, I think, illustrates that inextricable linkage between race and capitalism in a very dramatic and overt way, where we have 60% of those imprisoned in this country are people of color, even though there's only 30% people of color, especially black and Hispanics or Latinos, in the general population. So it's very systemic. It's not just a matter of someone individual trying to placate white nationalists. It's something that is systemic. And then, you know, you were talking about the tasering of youth in New York who, just because they're walking on the sidewalk, you know what that makes me think of? Makes me think of the slave codes and the black codes when, you know, black people had to move across the street, you know.
Or keep moving, right.
Yeah, when white persons were coming. And then when I see these videos, like the video of the girl in the bikini at the pool party back in Texas a few years ago. Remember that video where?
Yes.
Yeah, the policemen come to this pool party and draw their guns on black youth at a pool party and slam this girl with the bikini onto the ground and pound her head and then, you know, digs his knee into her back. You know, that level of unprovoked violence, if, in my mind, can only happen in a country that has a history like ours of slavery. Mm-hmm. When I see that video of Spring Valley High School of a security officer who's called to a classroom because the girl, the student sitting at her desk, refuses to give up her cell phone. She's on her cell phone. The teacher can't make her put it away. The teacher calls the officer. The officer comes in, he asks her to put it away, she does not, and his response is to pick up the chair that she's in, slam it down to the ground, and then throw her across the room. This mm-hmm. is a child. And it turns out, by the way, that the child is traumatized because she was just put in the foster care system, and she needed some help.
Right.
But my point, though, Esther, is this level of violence it can only happen in a nation with a history like ours, history of slavery. And I could go on and on. The fact that we are the most punitive and incarcerate the most of any nation on earth, including those nations that we call totalitarian, goes back to slavery to me. And the fact that we can have all of these police killings, you know, where police will call our youth monsters, you know, and demons, you know, like with Ferguson, can only happen in a nation like ours with a history like ours that goes back to genocide and slavery. And in many ways, we are still suffering from that because we haven't healed those original wounds.
So I want to kind of wrap a few different ideas I had into maybe one question because I realize I'm running out of time. But I wanted to get your sense of what's happening in the schools that is, I guess, increasing the repression of our young people and kind of conditioning them in a way to live in a neo-fascist state. I'm thinking about everything from the curriculum to the idea of being surveilled to going through metal detectors and like you, as you just mentioned, the presence of policing in schools when children are at such a young age.
Yeah, and you're asking if this is kind of a not so subtle, really, way of conditioning us to conditions of fascism. Mm-hmm. Of a militarized state and a police state. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you can certainly look at it this way. And, you know, the fact that we talk about the school-to-prison pipeline refers to this criminalization of our youth. Again, you've got race here, and you've got this deeply punitive impulse here at play. So echoing the rise of mass incarceration, you know, where the numbers in prison in this country increased by about 1,000%, you know, since 1970 to the present, echoing that in the schools, we saw the rise of the school-to-prison pipeline, which means that, as I said earlier, that our children are being criminalized instead of educated. It means that our schools are starting to look like prisons, you know, without windows and with metal detectors and with police. I never saw a police person the entire I only saw police when I went downtown. They were all white police, of course, in Alabama. But police at my school, police even in my community, which was a segregated black community. But the police are ever present today, including in schools, and something as simple as writing on a desk with erasable ink can get you charged with a crime of defacing public property. Normal adolescent behavior, like having a milk fight in the cafeteria with your best friend, you can get charged with assault. Having a temper tantrum, I don't know if you remember that image of a young person who had a temper tantrum and had been led out of the classroom with handcuffs on, a six-year-old. One of the youth that works for our organization was first suspended for theft when he was 4 years old just because he took the candy back that his principal had confiscated from him, and he was suspended for theft, and he got caught up in the school-to-prison pipeline and later was arrested for having a milk fight. I just described that. But that's part of what life is like for children in our schools. They are being criminalized instead of being educated. The good news is there's a lot of work resisting this, and that's one good thing that happened in the Obama administration and under the then Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan. A lot of work was done to transform these exclusionary and racially disparate discipline policies that we saw in schools and still see in schools. And work was done to interrupt the school-to-prison pipeline. A lot of work.
Was that work done by Duncan? Because I understand that he was kind of an advocate for a lot of charter schools.
Or was it?
It wasn't done by, I mean, it's usually, as you know, as always, when government responds, it's because people on the ground are making demands and are organizing and protesting. So to the degree that Secretary Duncan released directives to school districts all over the country telling them you're going to have to do something about this exclusionary discipline and the racism and discrimination that's going on in your schools. Racism isn't a thing of the past. It's happening today because you're disproportionately suspending youth of color. All of that was, I think, that happened because of the movement on the ground. So my mother was a school teacher, and she taught reading, first graders reading, and she taught, you know, early. She was an early childhood educator, and she, like so many black people, had a deep conviction that education is the way that we will liberate ourselves as a people.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking if she were alive today to see the kinds of things that are happening in our schools, that she would be very, very dismayed. Today's schools, unfortunately, too many schools don't provide opportunities for success. They offer pipelines to violence and prison. But as I said, I'm heartened by all of the work that's being done across the country to resist and change this.
Just two more things. I want to make sure that I touch on privatized schools, the privatization of schools, and our new Secretary of Education, and also end with, you know, the movement for Black Lives. So what is the role that you see in terms of the push by someone like Betsy DeVos to, you know, privatize more of our public dollars for schools, and what kind of impact does that have on the ground when you look at schools that you're familiar with in your area?
Yeah, so, well, I want to look at the history of public schools. Public schools got started by newly freed slaves. That's how they came about in this country. When slaves were freed in the late 1860s, these schools were created. Public schools for the first time came into existence in this country. And that's just an example of how kind of when you advance those of us who are at the bottom, the whole structure lifts. But the emergence of public schools not only benefited black people and former slaves, but ultimately benefited the entire public, all peoples. Mm-hmm. All citizens. So, I mean, that alone, for me, suggests that public schools are, you know, that's a victory that we have won, you know, just like the civil rights legislation of the 1800s and the civil rights legislation of the 1960s, and, you know, we protect that. And when we look on another level, we look at neoliberal policies of deregulation and privatization and austerity and tax cuts for the wealthy, and, you know, seeing this is a massive transfer of wealth from people, poor people and working people, to the 1%. Privatization, whether of schools, of prisons, of water in some places, of our infrastructure, is part of that whole assault against working people and poor people in this country. And, of course, when you privatize hospitals, when you privatize health care, you're going to get doctors who want to maximize profits and will give you surgeries or recommend and do surgeries that aren't medically necessary. But there's pressure on these doctors to do these surgeries because of the insatiable thirst and voraciousness of capitalism that seeks to maximize profit more and more and more at any cost. So instead of the health of the customer being the motive for the health care, it's profit to the private institutions. This is the case whether we're talking about prisons or schools or health care or water or libraries, there will be, in order to maximize profit, this is a law of capitalism to maximize profit, they will cut costs by any means necessary, eliminate services, reduce wages, eliminate unions, because the highest goal is profit. So it's part of the whole, you know, globalized capital assault that brought us to the 2008, you know, where millions of people lost their pensions and lost their wealth, regular working class people. And it's part of that assault that resulted in the Rust Belt and so many white families now, you know, who don't have jobs and who don't have benefits. And, you know, who because they felt left out and pushed out, ended up voting for Trump. But it's really globalized capital and privatization, globalized privatization that has led them to that. So that's my long answer to the question of privatization of schools. It's part of a much larger assault on people's rights in this country by capital, globalized capital.
Well, I want to just end with, I guess, some ideas of hope, you know, like how can the movement for Black Lives, and I in my own view, I kind of see restorative justice as part of the movement for Black Lives. How can that movement continue to be effective, you know, in countering, you know, this police terror? We have the Department of Justice backing away from oversight. You have white supremacists emboldened. You know, how can this coalition of a movement continue to be effective as you see in the coming years?
First of all, I just want to again acknowledge the movement for Black Lives, and especially the youth in Ferguson that in many ways were the spark that lit the prairie fire that resulted in Black Lives Matter, you know, for their having stayed out in the streets and slept in their cars and quit their jobs and had the longest protest in the history of this country other than the Montgomery bus boycott. I have to really acknowledge them, because it's because of their efforts that every newspaper across the world, not just in this country, was talking about Ferguson, and that because all of the newspapers and all of the mass media were talking about Staten Island and Freddie Gray in Baltimore and Alton Sterling and Philando Castile, it was because this has been going on, as we all know, for a long time, but it was because of the work that was done by those youth that we all know about it now. And I also need to name the fact that that movement has already transformed much in this nation. Police departments all over the country now are reviewing their policies and practices on use of force. So there is an awakening that we're seeing that is a direct result in terms of, you know, police violence. In police departments all over the country, that is a direct result of that activism. And I think that even with this Just Department, work can be done on local levels with these police chiefs who are now, you know, more aware about the need to train their police in excessive use of force and implicit bias, and working on the local levels and even on the regional level, instead of expecting the Justice Department to come in after a killing has happened and doing their investigation and doing their trials. That's not going to happen. But that's not going to, I don't think, in any significant way hurt the incredible work that is already happening now and that will continue to happen with continued activism. And then, you know, on I have hope, because as I said, even though I started out talking about the six or seven elements of fascism that I can identify that are alarming, there's no question about that. But I also mentioned that we see an unprecedented movement against Trump that can potentially become a movement against fascism. We see not only the Women's March, which we talked about at length earlier, we see town hall meetings going on, you know, in the hinterland even. We saw the protests at the airports and in the streets after the Muslim ban. We saw the judicial action. We see musicians, artists, actors, you know, cultural workers against Trump. We see first-time protesters coming out all over the country, not only in that march. And I was just reading about the first demonstration in space took place sometime this month, April 2017. They actually protested against Trump in space. It's the Aeronautics Space Association or something like that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So,
what, do they have some banners up there or what?
I need to get the details about that. I just got the headlines. But
okay.
It's the first ever demonstration that occurred in space, and it was just a few days ago against Trump. There's just this bubbling up of activism all over the country and even in the world. There were demonstrations against Trump all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the speed of these demonstrations, it took years to organize the March on Washington, which A. Philip Randolph and others did. But this women's march was organized virtually overnight. So the vigor, the speed, the size, the frequency of these demonstrations and the range of issues that they cover is unprecedented. So that all gives me hope. But I don't want us to become complacent. Because we said about Trump, oh, he'll never get anywhere.
Right.
He'll never get the nomination in the primaries. He got the nomination. Oh, okay, so he got the nomination, but no way he's going to win the presidency. No way. And in the biggest upset in electoral history in this country and probably in the world, you know, an Islamophobe, a transphobe, a xenophobe, a misogynist, a racist wins. And now we can say he would never become a fascist. He would never bring fascism to this country. So I can't, you know, I can't be complacent even with all of the incredible activism that I see across the country. I think that we need to go back to Georgi Dimitrov, which we used to read in the Panther Party and in the Communist Party and the Socialist Party, about how you combat fascism. And Georgi Dimitrov, Eastern European, I think he was Czechoslovakian, is probably the leading theoretician on how we defeat fascism. He's not just an armchair revolutionary or scholar. He kind of he laid the blueprint for how the people would defeat fascism in Europe especially. And we need to go back and start reading him on creating a united front against fascism. I think we have all the elements of that united front. And as Cornel West says, we need to build a multiracial alliance to combat, combat fascism. But it would need to have all those who have been demonstrating in the last 10 years or so against poverty, against xenophobia, against Islamophobia, against Wall Street crimes and war crimes, against the energy industry crimes, against global warming. All of these elements, you know, that we have seen bubbling up and arising in protest need to come together. And we need to include the white working class and the Rust Belt in this people's movement against fascism.
Mm-hmm. What seems to happen here in D.C. lately, I think, is the discussion is around the fact that, I guess, neoliberals want to kind of hijack the movement against fascism, but it is precisely their policies that has brought that have brought us to this point. So I think a big thing that I see happening over and over in terms of watching the news, trying to report on the news, trying to give some coverage, is the idea when you build that coalition, you know, how do you build that coalition and who are you going to be in coalition with? Because a lot of the people in the traditional Democratic Party, they are on a whole different time. They're still trying to relitigate the election. They're trying to blame Russia. They're trying to, you know, they're cheering the bombing of Syria. And they're still advancing a lot of these same neoliberal policies as if, you know, Hillary had won. Yet they want and they want to oppose Trump on that ground. But they're not talking about changing the system. They're not really talking about anything new that will take us out of the situation. If anything, it would probably double down on what we have right now. So when you said coalition, that's the first thing I thought about.
And I hear you. I really hear you, because I've heard Bernie say, yes, we need to bring a coalition together of the sort that I mentioned, a broad alliance of people under, he says, under the umbrella of the Democratic Party. His notion is that this coalition will take over the Democratic Party. And as I like a lot of things that Bernie says and does, but here we part ways. I am with Argy Lords when she says you cannot tear the master's house down by using the tools of the master. Hmm. We cannot defeat fascism and capitalism through the party of capital. The Democratic Party is a party of the master. It's a capitalist party. Mm-hmm. And if we are truly interested in creating a system and creating a socioeconomic system that is not driven by and obsessed by increasing profit, I meant, at any cost, if we're talking about creating an alternative socioeconomic system that is driven passionately by the interests of the well-being of all people, then we cannot do it under the umbrella of the Democratic Party. We need a third party that is rooted in the interest of the people instead of rooted in the interest of capital.
Well, we'll see what's going to happen. You know, a lot of people feel that by splitting liberals from the left, that we are going to continually be divided and continue to give a victory to the right. But on the other hand, I mean, we see what the Democratic Party did the last time. They systematically undermined Bernie Sanders' candidacy. Since then, they have undermined Keith Ellison. They've undermined every attempt for that more progressive coalition to take over the Democratic Party. They're resisting at every at every turn. So,
they are a party of capital. You know, that's what's causing all of the suffering all over the world.
Yeah.
But that's who they are. They are the ones who are doing that. They're causing that. Capitalism is what's causing all of this suffering.
Yeah. So it's one party. You know, people say the Democratic Party, Republican Party. It's really all one party. All right. Well, look, I thank you so much for spending this time with me and spending this time for this episode of The F Word. This is On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org. I'm Esther Averam, and I've been in conversation with Fania Davis. She's co-founder and director of Restorative Justice for Oakland Youth. She's a longtime social justice activist, a professor, civil rights attorney with a PhD in indigenous knowledge. And I thank you. Thank you so much, Fania Davis.
Thank you, Esther. Blessings to you.
And that will do it for today's show. Thanks again to my guest, Fania Davis, my guest for this month's episode of The F Word. You can reach the show at onthegroundshow.org, where you can listen to all of our shows. You can also hear On the Ground on iTunes under WPFW Pacifica Radio. Please like our Facebook and Twitter pages at On the Ground Show. I'm Esther Averam. Please tune in tomorrow, April 22nd, on Earth Day, when I will bring you voices of scientists here participating in the March for Science. Keep raising your voice. Peace.